G'day, and thanks for joining us for another Australia Talks, the official podcast of the r/Australian subreddit. I'm DK, and I'm joined, as always, by my lovely co-host, Deet. Today is Saturday, the 13th of March, and our topics this week are the Prime Minister has picked a new Governor-General, and Tasmania's giant native trees could be spared from logging, possibly. Possibly not. We'll get into that a little bit later on. Of course, we have our Two Ticks Town Talk, and then we're going to jump into This Week in Australian History with our Deet, and we're going to finish off, as always, with a 4X bottle top questions. This week, the questions have a theme. I won't tell you what that is until later on, but before we get into all of that, let's catch up on the last week. Deet, we're recording on a Saturday. I will tell the viewers why that is, or the listeners, I should say. What's been going on with you?
G'day, DK. And you do like a theme on your old 4X bottle top questions.
I do.
Which I look forward to. I just got back from a week up in Melbourne, the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. We were up there for 8 days. So it was a good bloody dose of comedy. We get a service department up there, which I think I mentioned on last week's episode, talking about how we set ourselves up. So if you want some details, go to there. But yeah, it was very good. I was just sitting down with wife today and sort of rating some of the shows that we'd seen together. I saw a number of shows after our main ones, and we thought, well, was very difficult to pick a favorite because we enjoyed them all. And that wasn't just sort of being, they're all really good. They were all very good. So, you know, some were a bit better than others, but all of them were pretty high quality. Well, were high quality. So that's a good hit rate. There's a couple of ones that I pick. So my wife goes to back, she sort of usually has had enough by the one show in the evening, and I'll sometimes usually always head out, and means I pick some that are more that she wouldn't be interested in anyway. And there was a couple of duds in there. But look, it's also my hit rate was pretty good. But yeah, no, there was one, and I would have walked out if I was near the door. But
really, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It was just, I don't know. I think she needed to have polished it more, and it wasn't really my sense of humor. It felt like it was early 20 person's sense of humor. And whilst that doesn't bother me, there was another one that I saw, and she had that sort of similar age bracket of humor. This one, it was actually getting annoying. And her she wasn't sort of polished, and once you've sort of seen a number of them who are very polished, it really sort of, you know, bloody sticks out.
Yeah.
When they're not. And look, I don't mind it. I've seen plenty that weren't polished, but they were fun. But you know, my hit rate was good. Another thing there, yeah, I got to wander around the city because we're there during the day, obviously. And I'd posted this picture on the r/Australian subreddit. I didn't know that the State Library of Victoria had Ned Kelly's armour. And
I saw you post that, yeah.
Yeah, I was more excited about it than I actually expected to be. My wife just sort of nudged and said, oh, look over there. That's Ned Kelly's armour. Took pictures of it, was reading all the stuff. It was just, I don't know what it was that really struck a chord with me, but seeing the actual iconic armor in the flesh, seeing where a number of the bullets had hit, just how it was actually constructed, and not just sort of a picture of it or a replica of it, and thinking, well, that's the real thing that legend is actually based on. I don't normally get excited too much by things like that, but it was a real highlight for me.
I think I've seen so many replicas that
yeah
I like high quality replicas that I would go there just to see that, to see the real deal, just because I feel like I've seen it. It's so iconic, that sort of boilerplate armor. And there's a place in Brisbane that has a really high quality replica of all four of their armor, because obviously Ned Kelly was the one we sort of normally think of, but the whole Kelly gang, all four of them, had their own set of armor. And it's kind of cool to actually see the real thing for once. The replicas, a lot of the replicas I've seen look damn near almost identical to the original armor. But you know, a replica is always going to be a replica. It's obviously not the real thing. So there's something kind of iconic. It's so Australiana in my mind, that image of the boilerplate armor like that.
Yeah.
Especially like you can see, like, he got hit a couple of times, and holy crap, that must have been scary. You know,
scary all round.
Babe, clanging off the armor. One of them is in his face, right sort of below his eyes. Oh, mate, terrifying. Not a great idea. you know, all things considered, but
it was interesting, and it's just sort of immortalized in, yeah, regardless of what you might think about Kelly or what was going on at the time or everything, just putting all that aside, the actual armor itself was pretty thrilling to see that icon.
Definitely. And to see it preserved like that, you know, you can see how the authorities might want to got rid of it and things like that. But the fact that it's still there and it's you know, pride of place, it's good to see. For our listeners that don't know who Ned Kelly was, long story short, he's become a bit of a Robin Hood-esque figure in Australian folklore. He was a bushranger, a highwayman, if you like. He robbed people. Primarily, he robbed banks. But they kind of had... He's a bit of a gentleman about it, if I'm honest. He killed a lot of policemen, though, so he's certainly not a good man. But he has a lot of fans, and kind of that idea of standing up to authority and that kind of stuff, because he did a lot of that. And his story is very, very good. I think if you don't know who he is and you're interested, there's been a couple of movies about him. Go and read his Wikipedia page. There's a lot about him out in the world, and a couple of good movies as well. So,
yeah.
Maybe one day we'll do a deep dive or something like that into the Kelly gang.
Look, we may well do too. There's certainly enough info out there. What about you? How was your weekend? Also, why are we on a Saturday?
Oh, what a whirlwind of a week. As our regular listeners will know, it's school holidays here in Queensland at the moment. They're about to wrap up. Tuesday, the kids go back to school. I was very upset to find out it's Tuesday and not Monday, but it is what it is. I had a good friend of mine that I haven't seen for many, many years, has just moved from Sweden back to Australia, and a bit of a surprise whirlwind visit popped up for a couple of days, which sort of knocked out our Thursday recording time. And then I've been away for a couple of days, full driving on the beach, getting out and enjoying this beautiful country. So I've sort of been not off-grid, but almost off-grid, I should say. There's one bar of reception there and nothing else. So, you know, you can get an emergency call out, but that's about it, really. And it's been nice to kind of disconnect and relax for a while. But as I was sort of discussing with Eddie before we started the podcast, I think I need a new swag. My swag is a bit, it's not a bit, it's very uncomfortable. And my neck hurts and my back hurts all after one night in a swag. So if you have any good swag recommendations, please feel free to shoot them in my direction, and I'll be happy to take any recommendations, because I don't think you can get much worse than the one that I have. and I'm happy to spend a bit of money on it to avoid, you know, horrible aches and pains. Yeah.
I think I've asked you this before. What is it that you like about a swag rather than a sort of a little, like, one-man, two-man tent with a blow-up mattress?
I think, in my mind, they're kind of the same thing, except, so again, we have a lot of international listeners that may not be aware of exactly what a swag is. And I know we've explained it before, but that was quite a while ago. A swag is basically a one-person tent. It's very low to the ground. You generally have to sort of, they open, often open from the top, and you sort of climb down into them. So you're on the ground. Often they'll have a built-in sort of a mattress, a little foam mattress built into them. And that's it. You can't really change in a swag. You can't really hang out in a swag. It's very much just for sleeping. The reason I like a swag is because it is kind of all contained within one thing, and it's easy to kind of pack up, pull it out, roll it out. Within 5 minutes, you know, you've got a, well, quote unquote, comfortable sleeping arrangement. However, mine's just not very comfortable. The padding, it's too thin. It's too small. I do have a double swag, which is significantly bigger. It's the size of a double bed, but it just takes up too much room. And that one is a lot more comfortable. But, and especially a single person sleeping in a double swag, it's very comfortable. You got lots of room in there. You could almost change in there. They're high enough that you could kind of sit up and change. But it, again, it's not super roomy. Like, you're not going to sit in there and play cards or anything like that, which you could with like a small two-man tent or something like that, a little pop-up tent. The reason I don't really like a pop-up tent is just, it's just something else to bring. The swag's kind of self-contained.
Yeah, that's
really it. It's just easy in that way. I don't have to worry about losing any parts or, you know, poles or anything like that. It's just kind of all, the swag all just rolls up. It just makes it easy. That's really what it is. It's just the convenience.
And you're not typically hiking in either, are you? You're driving into somewhere, so it's not as if you're having to worry about the extra weight of the swag.
Exactly. You know, if you were having to carry it, a swag would be a very awkward, difficult thing to carry. They're not exactly compact when they're rolled up. But which is where, yeah, if you were like backpacking or hiking or something, you would definitely want one of those really micro tent things that take up, you know, weigh nothing and take up hardly any room, and you can put it in your pack and all that. I don't know. I've actually been thrown around the idea of getting a rooftop tent, one of the hard shell rooftop tents. They're quite expensive for what they are. They're also very heavy, so I would have to take it off, which kind of makes it a bit awkward to deal with. Yeah. I mean, I could drive it into the shed and sort of have a endless chain type situation and crank it off, but that's a lot of setup, and, you know, how often am I going to use it and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, with all these things, there's pros and cons. Now, speaking of pros and cons, let's move on. Anthony Albanese, our Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, has announced that Samantha Mostyn is Australia's next Governor General. She's a prominent businesswoman and a gender equality advocate. Samantha Mostyn will be Australia's next Governor General. But wait, some of our foreign listeners are going, what the hell is a Governor General? Basically, in a nutshell, the Governor General of Australia is the representative of the monarch of Australia, which is currently King Charles III. They perform the constitutional duties, such as dissolving parliament, issuing writs for federal election, commissioning the Prime Minister, appointing ministers and assistant ministers, presiding over the Federal Executive Council, holding and possibly exercising the reserve powers, and the Governor General is also the Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Defence Force. It is a very important role. It is mostly ceremonial, I would say, in a lot of its... a lot of the powers that are bestowed to it are in a more ceremonial fashion, especially today. It is meant to be an apolitical figure. And of course, we've spoken before about Governor Generals exercising some of the rights that the powers that they have that may or may not have been politically convenient for certain people at certain times.
Mm.
So it is a very, very important figure in the Australian political landscape. As said, they are the representative of the monarch in Australia. Ms. Mosden is the current chair of the federal government's Women's Economic Equality Task Force and has previously served in a range of roles, including the AFL commissioner. She will be the second woman to hold this position, becoming Australia's 28th Governor General, the first being Dame Quentin Bryce, who served from 2008 to 2014. She'll be sworn in on the 1st of July, replacing David Hurley, who has served since 2019. Mr. Albanese described her as a modern and optimistic leader who is deeply respected in the business world. He said, and I quote, "Her leadership reflects our enduring Australian values of equality, fairness, and responsibility to build a better future for the next generation." She said her strong business experience and legal training would bolster her new position. She told reporters in Canberra, and I quote, "I can think of no greater purpose, Prime Minister, than to serve this country I love as Governor General, particularly at a time in our history when the challenges and opportunities we face are large and complex." She continued, "My connections to this country and a people have come in so many forms, from contributing to governance around executive investments and board tables, to cheering the footy, to being moved and inspired by in the audience at our extraordinary music and arts events, or packing food boxes in my local community. The beauty of Australians is our ability to pull together often despite our differences." She'd previously worked with Reconciliation Australia, Beyond Blue, and the Australian Council for Arts, and the National Mental Health Commission. As Commissioner for the AFL, she was central to establishing the Code's Women's Competition. And current Governor General David Hurley. Yeah.
It's been a very successful addition to the AFL. In fact, I remember seeing it. I'm not a big AFL person, as you and listeners know, but I do remember seeing a couple of games early on and thinking, this is actually, despite my misgivings when I heard of the idea, I thought that actually works. And it just seems to be going from strength to strength.
Yeah, it's they've done a really, really good job.
Bloody oath.
With creating a very strong league so quickly. Mm. The current Governor General, General David Hurley, has welcomed the announcement, calling Ms. Mosden someone dedicated to making a positive change in our community. He said in a statement that, "I have had the privilege of working with her previously and know that she will represent and serve all Australians with distinction. I congratulate her on her appointment as our next Governor General, and I look forward to spending time with her in the coming months and with all Australians supporting her as our Governor General." And I think this pick is kind of interesting, that Anthony Albanese has picked. I mean, any time that there's a change in Governor General, it's always kind of interesting to see who they've picked. Because the last, previously, the last five Governor Generals that we had have been retired generals, such as the current Governor General, David Hurley. He's an army general himself. Judges is another common one. Politicians, and we have had our bishop many years ago, but of the last five, three of them have been retired Australian Army generals. So I think it's interesting that she's coming from sort of the business world, which is generally not the where we sort of pluck candidates for Governor General from. Not to say that there haven't been business people that have fulfilled that role, but they're normally very specific into, like, they're lawyers or something like that. They have quite a niche understanding of Australian politics and Australian law, typically. So I think this is kind of an interesting one. It sort of took me a little bit. It did surprise me. I didn't see this coming, but I do think that she has a very impressive resume to her name. So how do you feel about this?
To be perfectly honest, the Governor General as a position doesn't overly fire me up, because the monarchy as a an institution also doesn't massively fire me up. And you couple that with my detesting of bureaucrats, and it's not up there in my hobby thing. However, it is, you know, it is all part of our system. And I looked at her resume, and I agree with you. That's definitely impressive. I thought your summary was good. I thought it was interesting that she's sort of come from such a business background. But I feel like part of that is if you are able to be successful in business in organizing a large number of people, as she seems to have been, and, you know, being actively involved with large organizations, that there is a similarity to the role as, you know, the head of the armed forces, which, and I'll come back to that because I need you to explain something to me, because I know you have a better understanding. But I can see that there is a similarity in managerial capacity between someone like her and, say, an ex-general who is looking after organizing people, logistics, and seeing structures and understanding their role without getting caught up in the minutia. So, look, at first blush, what I'm seeing from her seems to be a good resume. I watched her speech. My notes that I put down were, it was unexciting and inoffensive, but I tend to think that that's not a bad thing. We've had governor generals in the past who, I don't know, seem to be a little bit full of themselves, or seem to get more attention and self-aggrandizement than what I personally think is warranted with the position. So I'm going to reserve my opinion, but I'm going to say the first reserve my opinion until I've seen how she goes over the next, the next year, particularly as she's going to be going through an election or two transition. So, yeah, that's always interesting to see how they perform in that, because they are intimately tied with our political process in here. It's important how they play it, how they represent it. So from that ceremonial role, and also what can be an overly political role if it's not played correctly, I always think that's a good test. However, what I've seen so far, I like, and in my opinion, it's been a good start. So good luck to her. So that's my opinion on it. What I want to clarify with you, just because, you know, it's more sort of in your wheelhouse, the head of the armed forces, is that basically just titular, or is it actual real directional power, or is that power essentially owned by the Governor General but assigned to the Prime Minister? Can you, and the listeners, clarify that, please?
It basically is, as you've described. So technically, constitutionally, the Governor-General of Australia is the Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Defence Force. However, in practice, because of the role, as I said, is largely ceremonial, the government, you know, the Minister for Defence, the Minister's Cabinets, and the Federal Executive Council basically fulfil that role as Commander-in-Chief. Of course, we also have the Chief of the Defence Force and things like that. So there's a lot. It's not really, I actually kind of like how it's not specifically a single person. I know technically it is, constitutionally it is, but that's in practice, it's not really how it works here in Australia. So because, of course, the reigning monarch is kind of, he's the king, right? He can take charge of everything. But again, he delegates those powers out to Parliament and the Australian Parliament and so on and so forth. So It is sort of a holdover from years past, but I kind of do think it works well because it divides that power up into more like a team of people rather than a single specific person. However,
so where's the buck stop?
Well, this is the question. So, however, they at the end of the day, the Prime Minister's cabinet and the Minister for Defence, generally that's where the buck stops. Those guys are generally the ones that are calling the shots, even though they technically don't have the constitutional power to do so. The Governor General could overrule them. However, that's never happened before, and I doubt that it really will.
Sorry, go on.
I think, because I know that answer may not be very satisfying to some people, but the reality is the buck stops with the politicians in power. These are the guys that are making these sort of decisions. So,
and can they overrule? Like, are they... do they have the authority and power to overrule any member, and I'm using that to say right up to the top brass in the defence force? Are they above all of them?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So they are unequivocally above them.
Yeah, so the Governor General themselves used to wear a military uniform up until, I think it was the early 60s, I think it changed. And they do have their own ranking insignia and things like that. When I was in the Defence Force, Governor General Quinton Brice, she came down to HMS Cerberus outside just down your neck of the woods,
in
Melbourne. And we had a very large parade for her as the acting Governor General. She did a massive inspection of all the Defence Force personnel that worked there. So it wasn't just Navy, mostly Navy, but that's a tri-service base. So there's Navy, Army, and Air Force at that base. So with this huge parade and everything like that, took weeks to organise and probably was a huge waste of time, if I'm honest. But it's all ceremony and all that kind of stuff. So, so they are technically the head of the Defence Force, and they have their own rank and everything like that. So I don't think that they can be given, like, as much as I say that, like, I don't think they're not technically a member of the Australian Defence Force. So, like, as far as I know, I could be wrong, but, like, they can't themselves earn medals for decisions they've made and things like that. I don't think it goes that far. But yes, they are the Commander-in-Chief. They could basically pull someone into line and be like, nah, this isn't going to happen. The Governor General also appoints the Chief of Defence Force. So the current Chief of Defence Force, Angus Campbell, so he's leaving in July as well, and it's Vice Admiral David Johnston is going to replace him. So that must have been her pick, Sam Mostyn's pick, or it was Anthony Albanese's pick, and Sam just agreed to it, basically. So it's kind of, yeah, who's actually calling the shots oftentimes is the politicians that are kind of driving this. But that's not always the case.
So now, this might be using the wrong terminology in this, but could essentially Albanese order the Australian Defence Force essentially to do what he wants?
I feel like I need you to qualify that.
You're right. That's sort of a little bit. let's say, for example, let's take an extreme example. If he decides, listen, what's going on with East Timor and the arguments still with the resources and the oil between us and those bloody overlaps of maritime boundaries that we've discussed a long time ago, and which are now vague in my head. But if he got up and he thought, I reckon it's in Australia's interest to take over those reserves, and that's going to require military action against East Timor. Can he instruct the Defence Force, you may not like it, but you're going to go over there and take over East Timor? Has he got that power? And if not, who does?
I think yes. In a nutshell, the answer is yes. In reality, it's more complicated than that because it has to go through so many checks and balances and the process for military action and justification, and does this hold up, and you know, is this legal, and all those sorts of things have to happen before. You know, he can't just on a whim go, like in the US where it's kind of like the president can just be like, you know, we're going to invade Canada and basically everyone has to do it. It's not really like that here. There's a lot more separation of powers. But generally speaking, what the prime minister or the party in power wants to do, as long as they can justify it legally, it would happen, yeah. I mean, right. You know, we look at things like the invasion of Iraq, that the first Gulf War, second Gulf War, not so much, you know, the legality around certain things and all that sort of stuff. Even the Vietnam War, you know, the Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War is kind of, it's a bit muddy how it all kind of kicked off. From my recollection, there was the Australian consulate in Saigon requested the Australian government's military security, and that's kind of what kicked it all off. The government of South Vietnam, I don't think initially was the organization that kickstarted Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War. So there's little things like that where it can get a bit messy and stuff like that. But hey, that's kind of outside the scope of this podcast.
Oh, look, it was sort of related to it, and I knew it was an area where you've got some knowledge. And once there was something that you said, and I thought, oh, okay, well, that's going to be a good opportunity to clarify that a little bit more, because it is in keeping with her role.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's some fairly like fair criticism of her appointment. I know Pauline Hanson was concerned. I think it was from memory. I think it was Pauline Hanson was concerned. Sam said something about Australia Day, and she referred to it as Invasion Day, for example. So, you know, when you've got, and there's other things as well, when you've got a highly charged political landscape like we have in Australia, most of the world, any side you pick is going to anger the other sides, of course, right? And as a result, her extensive list of, protesting and being part of these sort of advocacy organizations and things like that have definitely rubbed some people the wrong way. And she's done a lot through a lot of different organizations in completely different fields, which I think really is a credit to her and her abilities. But it, for me, it kind of leaves it a little bit unsure of where her politics lie. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, I don't want to know, because that's kind of not really what the role is. So I think this is going to be one of those situations that we'll have to see in the next 12 months, 2 years, 3 years, how her role as Governor General sort of shapes up, if it changes at all. It may be very uneventful. A lot of them are these days, and they kind of just, you know, do their role, go do a lot of photo shoots and things like that, and you know, you kind of want an uneventful Governor General, so in some ways. So
yeah, look, and that's why I had noted down that her speech was sort of unexciting and inoffensive, and that was sort of what you want.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
It kind of is, actually. The governor generals, they're the best. They're kind of the governor generals that you forget. You don't even remember that they were. Oh, that's right. That happened. Anyway, let's move on. I think it's time for our Two Ticks Town Talk.
Right. This week for our Two Ticks Town Talk, we head to Bombala in New South Wales. So Bombala is a small rural centre in the southeast corner of New South Wales, right down on the southeast corner, on the Monaro Highway between Cooma and Cairn River. Agricultural area around the town's mixture of fine wool sheep, beef cattle, and timber, and the local rivers are recognised as some of the state's best trout fishing destinations and a home to substantial communities of platypuses. Principal industries of the area include grazing and timber and tourism, with specialty industries of meat rabbits, lavender, and herb growing. And it's probable that Bombala is a word for the Ngarrigu Aborigines who lived in the area prior to European settlement. And that can be translated as a place where the waters meet. It's got a population of just under 2,000, or just under 1,900. 1,892. A couple of factoids about the town. 1903, Bombala was proposed by King O'Malley as a possible site for the new federal capital because it was seen as being halfway between Melbourne and Sydney. Obviously, that ended up going to Canberra. But, yeah, Bombala was in the running. The town claims that the local rivers have the highest density of platypus in Australia, and still, even though the creatures are very shy and usually only spotted at dawn and dusk, just to make them challenging and capable of staying underwater for 40 minutes, they are still confident of seeing them and have a viewing platform at the local platypus reserve. There's also the Holy Transfiguration Monastery, which is a male monastic community of the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, which was founded there in 1982 and presided over by Abbot Hiram Monk Sergius. And it's in the valley nearby McLachlan River. It's just was interesting choice for, like, it just sort of surprised me that it was such a specific denomination there. But I don't have much more information on that one. That was just a factoid. On January 15th, 2022, a tornado touchdown, in the vicinity of the town. I sort of was a little bit dubious, looked at the video of it, and now it wasn't huge, but it was definitely a tornado.
We do have them here in Australia. They're very uncommon. They're not nowhere near as big as the ones in the States.
Oh, thank God.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Bloody hell, I see those monsters come along, and I think, oh, God, thank God we don't have them here. It's just... that would be a nightmare. So now, to find out what caught my eye about Bombala, I'll need to catch your ear. So I've given DK an audio file to see if he can guess what got my attention about Bombala. So I'll get him to listen to it now. And while he's listening to it, I'm going to play it for you listeners now too, to see if you can guess what it is. So I'll let DK have a listen to that.
Yeah, it sounds like Morse code, right? I'm not that familiar with Norse code, so I couldn't tell you what the sign is, but it's obviously quite short.
If you were.
It's quite short. but I'm very curious as to what the deal is with this little town making that sort of code. I can't even speculate what it is. Maybe something to do with like the SES or some sort of emergency services in the area would be my guess.
I reckon once we start into it, you're going to know exactly what we're talking about because of what I'll go into. Just for your the information, that is Morse code that spells out Bombala.
Ah!
So, yeah, I would have been mightily impressed if your Morse code was that good. The reason why I popped that little Morse code in there was on December 13th, 1962, Bombala Post Office received the last telegram to be transmitted using Morse code telegraphy in New South Wales. And the reason why I reckon you're going to have a feel for why this is of interest was because in our Two Ticks Town Talk, we often mention the old telegraph system in Australia.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And Bombala's place in its history, I thought, well, that's a good excuse to discuss it in some more depth. So that's where it came from. And that's what sort of caught my eye about Bombala. For all the places that if you'd asked me to guess, I would have thought, oh, yeah, somewhere in Sydney or, something like that would have been the last one. But no, it was Bombala. So,
wow.
Yeah. The Wireless Institute of Australia has a story of the last Morse code telegram. So it wasn't the last telegram, but it was the last telegram using Morse code. On December 13th, 1962, the last telegram and its reply were sent by Morse code in New South Wales. At the time, in a 50th anniversary reenactment, former telegraph operator Phil McGrath travelled to Bombala to send and receive a souvenir telegram to mark the occasion. At the time, Mr. McGrath sat at the sounding box and typewriter and received what was originally meant to be that all-important final message. So the final message at the time, which they used for the reenactment, given what it was, it read, "This telegram from Sydney to Bombala is the last message which will be sent by Morse in New South Wales, concluding 104 years of operation. Henceforth, telegrams to and from Bombala, like all other offices in this state, will be transmitted through the teleprinter perforator switching system, TRESS." And that's basically, instead of them using the Morse code keys, they type it in using a QWERTY keyboard. But then that was going to be sort of the final message. And this was a bit bloody difficult to find. I kept seeing this as, oh, yeah, last telegram in Bombala, last telegram there.
What did it say?
Well, yeah, exactly. I think just bloody, surely you can tell me what it said. So, look, thankfully the Wireless Institute of Australia had that. But the postmaster at the time, Bombala's postmaster, Stan Blyton, actually sent a 50-word reply that read, "My privilege, personally transmit last message from last Morse station, New South Wales. Key being forwarded, you relic was in use in inimitable 1919, where I joined service, remained there in use till station closed in 1960. Behalf old telegraphist and Morse code, old telegraphist and Morse operators, we bow to progress." So I personally consider that is the last telegram, not the one that was officially done.
Yeah, that I feel like the reply counts, doesn't it?
Bloody oath.
Yeah. It should count.
Well, I'm gonna count it, and here on Australia Talks, we are going to count it because
that's it. You've heard it here first.
yeah, exactly. So, look, it gave a lead into the Morse code telegraphy. So, look, let's go a little bit of its history, because that was it's just something that crops up so often, and we can refer back to this later on in other episodes when it comes up. So a bit of detail. Morse telegraphy was introduced to Australia in 1854, and that was only 10 years after Samuel Morse had transmitted the words, "What God has wrought," over a line between Washington and Baltimore. And Australia's first line ran from Melbourne to Williamstown in Victoria. That was significant to me because Australia, again, was a relatively early adopter of a technology. I mean, 10 years is not a hell of a long time for basic bureaucrats to get their bum into order, into gear, and say, yep, we need to do that. So it caught their attention. So Australia was a relatively early adopter of electrical telegraph technology in the middle of the 19th century, despite its low population densities and the difficult conditions sometimes encountered in laying lines. From 1858 onwards, the major capitals were progressively linked, culminating with the addition of Perth in 1877. When you hear 18 in front of these numbers, it's a long time ago. And it is, sorry, it seems like a long time ago, and it is a long time ago. But to give you an idea of what an advanced telegraph system was, here's some details about what happened in Victoria. So look, there were similar developments in other states, but Victoria is a good all-round example. And it was also the first state in Australia to do so in 1854. So in Victoria, the first telegraph line, which was sponsored by the Victorian government, was erected between Melbourne and Williamstown in 1853. And 1854 by a bloke called Samuel McGowan, who is a recently immigrated Canadian telegrapher. The line there was 17 kilometres, 11 miles, and went into operation in 1954, as I said, less than 10 years after the first public telegraph line. 4,000 telegrams were sent. 4,000 telegrams were dispatched in the first year. When the line was extended to Geelong in December 1854, the first message transmitted to Melbourne brought news of the Eureka Stockade, which is a nice little bit of Australian history to come across on that.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Connections to Queenscliff and Port Melbourne in 1855 provided notice of ships entering the harbour and arriving at port. Connections to the gold mining centres of Ballarat and Bendigo were both completed in 56, and by 1857, Victoria had been extensively networked by telegraph lines, including a line reaching to Portland near the South Australian state border. By 1867, which wasn't that long after it started, there were 1,676 miles, so just shy of 2,700 kilometres, of line within Victoria, handling 122,138 messages. Now, given the population,
that's a lot. Yeah.
Bloody oath. That's a huge amount.
That's what the gold rush gets, yeah?
Exactly right.
It's a massive engineering undertaking to build something like that. And I think at one point Melbourne was the wealthiest city in the world per capita or something like that. So obviously they put that money to good use. It's a shame we can't necessarily say the same thing today.
Oh, yes, exactly. Oh, my heart warms to hear you say that. And it's interesting you say that about the level of engineering, because, look, naturally enough, there was a strong drive to connect Australia to the rest of the world, because this thing was just I suppose it's one of those things that solved itself. So, look, as I said, that was just a concentration on Victoria. All the other states were doing similar things. So there's competition between these states to connect to overseas. That was fierce competition both from the state governments and the various companies vying for the business. As you would imagine, it was no different to what it is nowadays when you've got a big infrastructure project. South Australia eventually outbid Queensland, and one of the great engineering feats of 19th century Australia and probably the most significant milestone in the history of telegraphy in Australia was built, and that was the overland telegraph. Now, this was impressive. There's a bloke, John McDougall Stewart, who'd been previously commissioned to explore a remote outback in northern Australia, because this is when Northern Territory, today's Northern Territory, was part of South Australia.
Which is just so weird to think. South Australia was all most of the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So he had a couple of cracks at the hitting the northern coast and eventually got there in 1862. And that was despite fears before the expedition that there were going to be vast inland seas that may block a route. And even though it was an extreme route, a bloody oath is extreme up there, they found a path. So they get a put a contract out in 1870, and following immense physical hardship and considerable logistical challenge, the overland telegraph that ran from Port Augusta to Port Darwin was completed on 22nd of August 1872, which again, not that long after the introduction to telegraphy in Australia of 1854. I mean, that's only, I'm blanking on, is that 18? 72 minus 54, that's 18, isn't it? Have I stuffed that up?
You're putting me on the spot here now.
we'll edit this out afterwards, and I'll just flick it to you, and you'll say immediately, "Yes, of course it is."
yeah, of course it is.
Yeah. People say, "God, bloody God, even DK quick on the maths." Okay, that's not that long. 18 years. So to build the line to Darwin, 36,000 poles were used to close the nearly 3,000-kilometer gap. And the Australian Overland Telegraph was used for sending messages between Darwin and Adelaide. When it was the reason why that was so important was it allowed fast communications between Australia and the rest of the world, because it was linked to a submarine cable going from Java to Darwin. So one of the beauties of these things is once you actually have a link to part of the network, you've got a link to the whole of the network. Similar to the internet today. I mean, it's that exactly, well, not exactly, but it's a very similar thing. So that meant that the communication time with Europe dropped from months to hours, and it meant Australia was no longer so isolated from the rest of the world. It's a really significant step in the Australia joining the rest of the world in a communications sense. So, yeah, not surprised that they gave it such a kudos as an engineering thing. And then they did so that was north-south to bring WA into the fold. They put up the east-west telegraph. So in 1874, the South and Western Australian legislators voted for some money to construct Port Augusta to Albany, which allowed it was a colony then of WA, to connect to the actual overland telegraph and therefore to the rest of the world via the undersea cables to Indonesia and beyond.
That's still such a massive distance.
Isn't it?
You think about Western Australia and Perth, is almost like on an island, really. Like, it's so far away. It's so isolated. Albany's not even Perth. You've still got several hundred kilometres after that. But that's got to be 2,000 kilometres worth of telegraph lines, which is just a massive amount of work to do. To put how many poles? You got to cut down entire forests to get enough friggin' telegraph poles to.
Oh,
it would have been a huge. But again, at the same time, you know, obviously they're stopping along the way. So some of these little towns, which, you know, as we've spoken about, as sort of is the topic of this week's Two Ticks Down Talk, is these massive infrastructure projects kind of put some of these places on the map as a result.
Absolutely nailed it, DK. That's it. Exactly what happened. And particularly in the early days, you had to have areas where there were sort of repeaters and people were sort of serving as the hub. And because it had the telegraph station there, it became a source of information. And therefore, once it becomes a source of information, it becomes a source of trade. And it attracts a population, it attracts business, and as you correctly said, it's part of so many of the towns that we've looked at around Australia. It was interesting on this one. It sort of drove that home to me in a way that was more sort of significant when I've just mentioned it before. So yeah, look, there was the social impact. So that, yeah, a telegraph, the idea of a telegraph system seems quaint now, but it had massive social impact in a similar way to the internet and the World Wide Web and mobile phones. The largest customers by far were government, business, and the press. So before the telegraph, news and mail could take 3 months to reach England.
Wow.
Yeah, 3 months. Reduced that to 7 hours. Imagine that.
Wow. A difference.
Oh, bloody oath. Yeah, imagine you're a business person and you're thinking, well, did my goods arrive? Are my goods on the way? You know, am I going to have a sunk ship? Am I going to actually be getting that new, those new supplies in? It doesn't take many trips at 3 months where you've essentially got a year to do some business. And all of a sudden, in a couple of days, you can have that information.
It's so wild because it's so opposite to how we run our world now. You know, it's like borderline instantaneous information everywhere all at once. You know, we whinge if our overnight express post delivery is delayed or something. That thinking about it like that, 3 months to get send a letter, holy moly, that is just it's a different world.
It is a different world. So you can understand why it was a fundamental change in society. Business community, it increased their prosperity and wealth. City and country telegraph offices, as we just said, became centres of trade where orders were placed, banking was transacted, market information was exchanged. There was the administrative, scientific side. One of the things that telegraph system was used for was to keep the time of the nation. So time signals were transmitted. Transmitted to all telegraph stations in each colony at 1 o'clock each day, and weather observations were likewise transmitted back to the state capitals. So yeah, all those, sometimes we're so used to seeing time. And we're so used to it. It's on your wrist, it's on your phone, it's up on the wall. But knowing the correct time and knowing that your time is coordinated with someone else's time 3,000 miles away can become so important in so many different situations. It's just one of those things that it's part of our life. But when you examine it a bit closer, you understand the importance of it. So, yeah. So towards the close of the 19th century, Australia had become one of the largest users of telegraph in the world. The usage continued to climb within Australia, peaking at 35 million messages per annum in 1945. which is it's a lot of bloody messages. I mean, yeah. even by today's standards, that's still a big figure. The telephone came in and said, look, thereafter the telephone continuously eroded the use of telegrams. Both because of like the price, like the relative price of it, and the network service improvements. And additionally, from 1954, teleprinters handled more and more traffic. So they were ones that would just sort of automatically communicate messages and didn't quite use the old style Morse code telegraphy system. So the one that we mentioned earlier, the automated switching system, where you could just type it into a keyboard, enhanced the utility of the teleprinters by allowing messages that were centrally directed to be automatically retransmitted to their final destination without the need for a human operator. So in other words, you could use a machine on one end, and all it had to do was talk to the machines all along the way, rather than have a human operator intervene and do the retransmission. So, yeah, like a lot of things humans do, it was a continual refinement and improvement.
And that's it. I mean, it goes the telegraph directly, you know, turn into basically the telephone system and the fax system, yep. And now we have the internet. It's all kind of built on top of the previous previous ideas we had before, and literally the infrastructure. I'd imagine a lot of those old telegraph lines were turned into telephone lines at some point.
Yes, and if they weren't directly, certainly the laid out routes would be used for that. You know, they'd be upgraded for that. So by 1975, telegram usage had halved from its 1945 level. And then finally, in 1993, Australia Post discontinued its lettergram service, which consisted of postage delivery, telegrams in inverted commas by that stage, but they were delivered in the same manner, although they weren't actually transmitted over telegraph lines. They just had that old feeling. And that similar sort of layout, and you had to pay for. You're still sort of having to pay for each word, because I mean, it's before your time,
yeah.
But I'm old enough to remember my parents receiving these lettergrams, and I think there was a birthday for an auntie, and it was all very exciting because we had to go down to the post office and send her a lettergram, but you had to work out how you could express your sentiments as economically as possible, because I can't remember what it cost, but it was one of those things of every word cost you money. So you couldn't sort of faff about, but it was trying to strike that balance between let's be a little bit emotional and heartfelt, but let's also not like piss the money up against the wall. So
you can still send telegrams, but they're basically a digital thing now. They call them a telegram, but they're not really a telegram. And the reason telegrams still exist is because there is, for certain industries, there is still like legal precedent that a telegram is like a legal document and things like that. So with certain business contracts and things like that, you can use a telegram instead of, say, like an email or something like that. So there kind of is this weird niche telegram. Like if you, or listeners now, if you Google like send a telegram, you'll find a bunch of companies that will do it for you. They just print it out and send it in the post, like, and notarize it as a telegram. So it's not quite the same thing, but it's close.
Huh, didn't know that. That's interesting. I can understand there still being some legal hangovers.
But it's weird that it does still exist, especially because we have email, right? You're like, why do you need a telegram if we can use email? There's receipts, you know, it's all time stamped, blah 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 blah. But yeah, for some parts of the world and things, it's telegram is still preferred. which is very weird.
So, look, it's amusing to think that the Morse code spelling out Bombala near the beginning of this segment was done using my phone connected to the internet, requesting a file from a website based on what I import. So that while my creating the Morse code file and the original transmission of Morse code telegrams are worlds apart, there is a commonality that ties them together, which I sort of find quite interesting. And it makes me wonder what technology Australians will be using 150 years from now and how close or different it will be in concept to the last Morse code message sent to our Two Ticks town of Bombala in New South Wales.
Very cool. What a step back in time this week was. Let's move on. Thousands more of a Tasmanian giant native trees could be spared from logging under a new policy change. Tasmania's practice of logging continues centuries-old trees and received international attention and condemnation last year when one was trucked through the center of Hobart and the logging truck drove straight through Hobart and it had a single tree on its back. Now, I want you to picture a logging truck. Most people are familiar with what a logging truck kind of looks like, piled high with logs all piled in the back. This truck just had one tree in it. It was that big. It was huge. And as a result, international condemnation, as rightfully so. And now the state's public forestry company, which trades as Sustainable Timber Tasmania, that's a good name, has changed its policy around the logging of what it calls giant trees. So it would previously give protection to giant trees based on whether they were taller than 85 meters or greater than 280 cubic meters in volume. Basically, this amounted to trees that were 5 meters in diameter or more, which is absolutely huge. And as a result, very few trees would qualify for protection, hence the truck driving through the middle of Hobart. This has been updated to trees wider than 4 meters in diameter, which, again, sounds good. And this measurement is taken 1.3 meters above ground level on the hillside, the uphill side of the tree. The problem is the tree that was driven, that was felled and driven through the center of Hobart wouldn't have qualified for protection even under this new definition, which is kind of disgusting. STT identifies the tree in Coops and it plans to log, and then it gives them a buffer where the forest is retained around them. So it is quite good. If there are particularly giant trees that are protected, they do have a buffer around them. But the actual specific size of the buffer zone is not specific. Generally, it's about 100 meters around that specific tree. So Steve Pierce from the Tree Projects has been in discussion with the STT about protecting more of the giant trees. He estimates that the new policy would save thousands of additional trees and thousands of hectares of native forest around them, including about 150 trees in what they call the Grove of Giants in the Huon Valley. This is just outside of Hobart. It's about an hour's drive from Hobart. The policy change brings Tasmania into line with Victoria's definition, although Victoria no longer logs native forests at all. It's also behind a similar policy in Canada, where trees greater than 2.5 meters in diameter are protected. That feels like a better... 2.5 meters feels more fair. Last year, as I said, images of a single rider logs being transported in Tasmania, those that only just fit on the back of a truck, were shared around the world, bringing further attention to the state's logging practices. Those logs appear to be smaller than 4 meters in diameter, which means they would still be logged even under this policy change. It is unclear how many giant trees exist in Tasmania's native forests available for logging, as it would require an on-the-ground survey of nearly 800,000 hectares. It's a lot of area. They also only reach such a size, though, in very specific topographic environments, such as the Grove of Giants, and they are unlikely to reach the side at that size at higher altitudes. A tree 4 meters in diameter, though, is an absolute monster of a tree and is probably between 400 and 500 years old, which is just incredible. Now, I'm going to send Deet a link to a photo from the tree projects. This tree is called Gandalf's Staff. It's actually a poster that you can purchase of a photo or a collection of photos that were taken of this specific tree. Just give you an idea of the sort of scale of these trees that we're talking about. We'll link this one in the show notes, and I would recommend go and having a look. Just not specifically that I want to link to the poster, but it is a fantastic image of this one tree that stands 84 meters high, and they've said it's 280 cubic meters of tree. And you sort of can't really appreciate the scale of it until you realize halfway up what appears there is a tiny, tiny person on the side of this tree, because it's as big as a skyscraper, bigger even.
Shit. Oh, God, I can see. Bloody hell, I'm glad you pointed that out. Shit.
Yeah.
That is enormous.
Absolutely huge. It's a huge tree. And unfortunately, fortunately, it is now protected by this new definition. However, some of its smaller siblings in similar areas, they're not going to be protected under this new law change. So I think it doesn't go far enough. We've spoken about native logging in Tasmania in the past. Look, I'm not some bleeding heart greenie that wants to, you know, not to cut trees down, but I do think there's a value in protecting some of these giant ancient trees that are of this size.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, DK, on that. I'm not really I'm not a greenie in terms of saving all the trees. I sort of feel like there's a realistic side of you either mine it or you grow it, and that's really how humanity progresses. And I'm on team human as a blanket statement, but big but, you see some of these massive trees, and that one that you sent, that picture of Gandalf's staff, I mean, that reminded me of one of those things you see in those Guinness Book of Records photos of, you know, world's tallest man or world's tallest woman standing around normal people, and there's this just giant person in the middle of it, and you look at that Gandalf's staff, and it's like there's the forest, and suddenly there's just this humongous tree in the middle of it. And if we were in the situation where the only way we could survive was to cut down these beautiful giant trees, I would be reluctantly erring to say if it's a tree or people, for a good reason, because I've got a little asterisk and a caveat there that I'll put there in a moment. If it was a good reason, I think okay, I can accept that. But the thing is, as you were talking about with that, what'd you say, 800,000 hectares?
800,000 hectares, yeah.
Yeah, ridiculous amount. If you can't get a good haul of native forest without cutting down these big, beautiful trees, well, then you're just not being serious about it. And for that reason, much as you have the little bit of a pushback against government stuff, there's a certain air of reasonableness to this that I can go along with. I'm probably inclined to agree with you when you made that that side comment about I think it was Canada that had 2.4 meters or something, and saying that was probably a bit more reasonable. I wouldn't mind the playing field being made a little bit harder and having a limit in like that. And if it has to get revisited later for the industry and that, then so be it. 4 meters is just a massive amount. 2.4 meters is still a bloody huge tree. I mean, that's a big girth of a tree. So,
and these trees are hundreds of years old.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you don't get to several meters in diameter without living for a bloody long time. I've just sent you some pictures as well of the logging trucks, and it seems almost surreal seeing a logging truck with just one log on the back. It almost looks like maybe it's a toy or something, because it just doesn't look right. It just looks so unusual. And look, I understand that I'm certain that these trees are highly prized for their timber. They probably fetch an enormous amount, and I'm sure they fill the homes of wealthy people's, you know, dining tables and desks and things like that. But the reality is, I think it's a huge shame to destroy something kind of so special and unique. There aren't many of these giant trees, and I think we should sort of protect them. And the difficult thing as well is you kind of go, oh, well, can't we just do like an aerial survey or something like that to find them? No, not really, because a lot of the time, because they're in a forest, obviously, and quite often they're in sort of like gullies and things, you don't really understand the full scale of the tree from the air. You really have to be on the ground, which makes it even harder. Like I said, 800,000 hectares. You can kind of make that number a lot smaller if you do start understanding where the conditions are right for these trees to grow, because they can't just grow everywhere. So you can kind of whittle it down. And there are a handful of volunteer organizations and charities that are going out specifically and looking for these, and they are climbing them, and they are measuring them, and they're photographing them, and they're cataloging them for protection. And look, I probably wouldn't go to that level of dedication for this, I'm ashamed to say, but I am very grateful that these people are doing that, because I think it is something worth saving. I think it's something worth protecting. And not just cutting down and selling off, because that is a shame. Look, and like I said before, I don't actually have a huge problem with native logging, as long as it's done in a sustainable way, as long as it's done in a responsible way, and you're not going down and cutting down, you know, huge trees like this. It's just such a shame.
Yeah, and I think the putting the thing of saying, well, having to do the surveys and that, I think that's a bit of a distraction, because look, if you're planning to log an area, you're going to be planning to log an area of, you know, I'm not a forester, so I might be, you know, talking out my ass, but I am going to be fairly comfortable in saying that you'd be surveying the next 100 square hectares of where you want to go, because you have to, just for sheer economics. You have to say, well, what's the terrain, what's the access, what's the actual profitability we can expect from it. So if you're talking areas like that, that's more than ample to identify one of these giants and to cordon off the area around it. So I don't think you have to actually survey ahead of time in order to be able to effectively enforce and monitor this rule. I mean, you can, if you wanted to get people such as those volunteers in there, they can give a tick on, yeah, we've looked at that area and we agree there's none of these ones that are classified as a giant. So I think you can manage it in a very progressive thing. Doesn't mean you can't go ahead and say, look, here's a particularly valuable area, and advise the logging people, just avoid that all up, because you're not going to get anything out of it. You can still talk profit hand in hand with greenness and ecology, and work out a middle road to satisfy both people and still preserve these beautiful trees. I mean, look, and I got a bias, I think, because we both think they're beautiful trees. To some people, they're just, just a bit of wood. But I think you can, I think you can tread that line.
I think as well, what's a shame, and this comes from the Tree Project's website, so they are pretty heavily biased in showing the bad things, but they did show a tree that was felled in 2021, I believe, by Sustainable Timber Tasmania, and it would have qualified for protection under the new definition. It is so large that once it was felled, they couldn't remove the entirety of the tree because it did not fit. It did not fit on the back of a truck.
Wow.
So, there's just, and again, Sustainable Timber Tasmania, that name, is Tasmania's state public forestry company. So this is a government organization that's doing this as well. And like I said, I understand it's a huge industry. It employs thousands and thousands of Tasmanians. It is important for the state economy and the national economy. I've probably got Tasmanian timber in my house right now.
Mm.
I do think, though, like you said, there's a balance we got to strike between the destruction of everything, and the unsustainability. And generally speaking, a lot of these companies are fairly sustainable because that's their work, right? Yeah. I personally know, I have a few good friends that do work in forestry in Tasmania, particularly up north and in the west, and they're the biggest tree lovers you'll ever meet. They love
trees. What the oath? Yeah.
That's why they do this.
Yep.
Yeah. They absolutely love it, and they really, really appreciate what goes into it. However, I think if some of them knew that some of these big trees were being forested further south from where they are, I think they'd be pretty upset by it, if I'm honest. So, look, it's good that this change is happening. I think it probably doesn't go far enough, and I think it probably needs to change. But, some progress is better than no progress. And I just think it's quite interesting that international condemnation basically forced this change. If that truck hadn't driven through Hobart and got photographed the way it did and go viral the way it did, some of these giant trees that we're appreciating now very possibly could be on the chopping block, literally. And that's not to say as well that some of these giant trees must be an entire ecosystem for native birds and insects and all the rest of it. So, look, we may come back and visit this if this does change in the future. Might give you guys an update if it cuts down. If this particularly annoys you, call Tasmania and tell them that you want to change.
speak to your MPs, because this is also the type of thing where you can contact Tasmanian members of their parliament down there, but you can also use your local MPs and senators to exert some pressure federally on this. These type of issues do tend to attract some federal, interference. I mean, let's call it what it is. Yeah, if you want your local member or your federal member to interfere in what's going down here, get on the blower or send them a letter.
Damn straight. Let's move on. Talking about all those trees has made me wonder what's happened this week in Australian history.
All right, this week in Australian history, we're covering the 5th to the 11th of April. April 5th in 1932, racehorse Farlap is found dead. I think it was a conspiracy that Farlap was poisoned or something by
that rings a bell.
Yeah, that does ring a bell.
Yeah,
might have to look at that another time. But yeah, 2004, Australia's biggest supplier to the farming community of the potential explosive ammonium nitrate decides to pull the product from its stores in response to concerns it could be used by terrorists. That was a big thing. The nitrates packed into the vans with the diesel.
Yep. Ammonium nitrate explosion is what caused the Beirut explosion. Absolutely horrifying explosion. Yes. Yeah. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well remembered. April 6th in 1844, 10 years before the first telegraph, John Gavan is the first European settler to be legally executed in Western Australia. He was executed for murder at the age of 15. 1895, Waltzing Matilda is first performed at the North Gregory Hotel in Winton, Queensland. 1942, the 41st Infantry Division arrives in Australia. During World War II, 1 million Americans were stationed in Australia. I didn't realize it was that many Americans.
It was
a lot. A shirtload.
Mm-hmm.
Was that at one time or rotated? Do you think it was?
Yeah, I don't think it was all at once. They would send them here for like R&R, basically. And I think they were spread out between Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. And very famously, there was the Battle of Brisbane, I think we've covered before,
yeah.
Where military personnel from the Australian Defence Force and the US Armed Forces got into a bit of a kerfuffle over some ladies, some pay disputes, and had a few too many drinks and all the good things. which definitely happened more than I think people realize, because all that sort of stuff was kept quite hush hush. So yeah, it was a lot. There were a lot of them here.
Mm, bloody oath. April 7th, 1841, Edward John Eyre becomes the first European to cross the Nullarbor Plain and arrives in Western Australia. Now,
that's why everything's named after him.
Yeah, exactly. I've only driven across to Western Australia from Melbourne once across the Nullarbor, well, there and back, obviously. I don't really know how the long haul truckers do it. I suppose you get into a mindset and you have to be a certain type of person. I mean, it's a bloody good drive. Like, it's a really good drive. Although I remember coming back Northman, the hotel that we were meant to be checking into on the way back. There was one there, and when we went into it, we thought, oh, this is just a putrid room. And we decided, oh, stuff it. We're just going to get on there and see how far we go. And we'd taken off in the morning, and it was it was getting dusk, and then it was getting a real sort of dark, just after dusk. And the amount of bloody kangaroos that were out. We ended up driving, I think it was about 20 k's an hour, and we still had bloody kangaroos, you know, bumping into the front of the car and bouncing off. And I said to the wife, look, we just can't do this. We're just going to have to pull over. And she said, oh, God. I remember she was in the driver's seat at that stage. And she said, oh, God, I don't want to pull over here. It's by the side of the road. We're out in the middle of nowhere. I'm not sort of happy about this. And I turned around to get something out of the glove box and looked back, and she just completely asleep. absolutely conked out. It was just, oh, this is terrible. I snored then. She's not really a big snorer. She wouldn't like that if I heard it. But it was just, it's always amused me that we found this little spot and was sort of like, oh, this is not going to go well. It's just bang, conked out. Mind you, we'd been on the road. Oh, must have been about 14, 15 hours or something. And then that driving and just sort of thinking, oh, shit, there's another little kangaroo. And we weren't hurting them, just in case people are listening in. We're driving slow enough that they would just jump into the car and bounce off. But, you know, I mean, there's a limit to how far you can go across the Nullarbor at 20 kilometres, 25 kilometres an hour.
It makes for a very long journey. Oh,
way, way too long. Finishing off April 7th in 1967, Peter John Badko died in the Vietnam War. He was awarded the Victoria Cross for bravery, conspicuous gallantry, and leadership on more than one occasion. April 8th, 1802, the explorer Matthew Flinders meets the French explorer Nicolas Bourdin at Encounter Bay. And that's the same Bourdin from the expedition discussed in our Tooticstown talk on Nunes, New South Wales, part two. Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, where we revealed the plot by the French to invade Australia. Yeah, so same bloke. 1817, Australia's first bank, the Bank of New South Wales, that's now Westpac, is established. 1933, a secession referendum in Western Australia passes with 68% voting in favour of secession from the Commonwealth. And as we've discussed in previous episodes, that went nowhere because it was a vote that those in charge didn't want to have happen. So the people weren't listened to once again. April 9th, 1865, Bush Ranger Dan Morgan, I think he was Mad Dog Morgan, it might have been, is shot and killed at a Peachalbar station in Victoria. April 10th, 1851, the New South Wales Association for Preventing the Renewal of Transportation sends a petition to Queen Victoria. 1941, the Siege of Tobruk begins. For most of the siege, Tobruk was defended by the Australian 9th Division under General Sir Leslie Morshead. That was the Rats of Tobruk, wasn't it?
The Rats of Tobruk, yep.
April 11th, 1921, Bert Hinkler flies from Sydney to Bundaberg nonstop, breaking his own long-distance flying record. 1934, Charles Olmes successfully delivers the first airmail from Australia to New Zealand. And rounding out April the 11th, 2001, Australia... You remember this one?
I know this one, yeah.
Oh, poor bastards. Australia defeats American Samoa 31-0 in 2002 FIFA World Cup qualifying game, which was an international record. Now, I'm almost certain that after that match, there would have been a beer or two. What do you reckon, DK?
I definitely think they would have been. So let's move on to our 4X bottle top question. So the theme this week is trees.
Ah!
Neither of these came from a bottle cap. But, and these are fairly, well, these are reasonably difficult. So I wouldn't expect you to get them. I'll be very impressed if you did. The first question is, how tall is the tallest tree that is alive today that we know about? Should qualify that we are aware of.
Anywhere in the world?
Anywhere in the world. I'll give you a tip. It's not in Australia.
No, I have it. When you said that, I have a feeling it was one of those giant redwoods.
Yes, it is.
Oh, damn it. And I remember years ago being bloody amazed when I heard some figure, which is not coming back to me, like it was just a stupid amount of height. Let me see if I can
So remembering Gandalf's staff, the tree from before, was just over 85 meters.
Yeah. I had for some reason, I had 120 meters in my head. But that's eucalyptus. I'm going to go with what popped into my head and say 120 meters, which is a freaking huge tree.
You're so close. The tallest tree, a living tree today that we know of, is 115.7 meters.
Wow, what a tree.
It's called Hyperion. It's named after the Greek child, the child of Greek titans, Gaia, meaning earth, and Uranus, meaning the sky, which is quite a fitting name, I think. It is a coast redwood, so it's one of the giant redwoods, and it is located in the Redwood National and State Parks in California, the United States, and to protect the tree, its exact location is actually kept secret.
So how do they keep something so enormous secret?
This was my question. How do you keep one of them, these trees, secret? And the thing is it's not the tallest tree from sticking out at tree level. As I sort of alluded to before, the canopy of the trees is deceptive because sometimes there's gullies and things like that you can't really be seen from the tree height. So a tree can be a lot taller than it appears to be. And for the sake of this specific tree, it seems like that is the case because there have been a lot of people trying to look for it. It is in a protected area, and I do believe it's also completely off a trail. There's no direct trail to it or anything like that. So it's specifically kept secret to protect it, which is pretty cool. Interestingly, if you stood it at the water level in Sydney Harbour, it would be almost as tall as the flagpole on top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
That's a good comparison. Yep.
So the flagpole on top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, I think, is 135 metres. This is 115. So it wouldn't quite get there, but it's close enough. That kind of can give you that visualization of how tall this one specific tree is. So it is very, very impressive. Huh. So I'll give you that. You were close enough. I'll give you that one.
I'll take that one.
This one's a little bit of a trick question. I think you'll get this one fairly easy. But what existed on Earth first, trees or sharks?
I mean, I'm heavily biased towards trees because that's turned out to be a bit of a theme in this one, and I have that image in my head of early Earth having all those little plants and greenery growing, but also too, sharks are often talked about as being just these really old, efficient killing machines, and there's a lot of energy in a tree. Oh gosh, this is a 50-50 toss up. I am going to go sharks because I reckon trees might have been one of those sort of step ups in evolution on land, whereas I can imagine sharks just hooning around the ocean before much was happening on land. So sharks is my guess.
Sharks are older than trees. So sharks have existed for more than 450 million years, whereas the earliest tree, I should qualify this. There's an asterisk there. The earliest, like, agreed upon what we would consider a tree lived about 350 million years ago. There's a 100 million year gap there between sharks and trees. Interestingly, large tree-like plants evolved a certain type of fungi that appeared to look of a similar structure to a tree did exist before what we call trees and what we know of now as trees. And sort of that definition there is what we call the lignins that are inside the plant that kind of give it that woody structure. What we now know of, when you look at a tree, it can be like, that's a tree. But there was a period.
As opposed to a big floppy fungus.
Yeah, or as opposed to, say, like a fern or a type of grass or something like that. Obviously, these are different things. And what's more interesting is for about 60 million years, bacteria hadn't developed the ability to break down lignins, which meant for about 60 million years, if a tree died, if a tree fell in the forest, it did make a sound, and then very little happened to it. It didn't sort of decay and rot. It just kind of was there. It just stayed there on the ground because very little could actually break down those lignins in it.
That's interesting. Really interesting.
It is very weird period in human history. And they do think
human,
well, Earth history, I should say, not human history, in the history of our planet, I should say. And they do think this is where a lot of the coal came from, because those plant structures weren't broken down, especially in boggy areas in terms of swamps and things like that. And it would kind of just get carbonized, because a lot of the coal that exists on Earth is from the same period of time in the crust. And it's about this period of time. So they think that's part of the reason why coal is so abundant at that period of time in the history of our planet. So there you go. More information than a 4X bottle top question section should be. but when I was looking for tree trivia questions, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole. And
that's pretty enjoyable, though.
So, thank you so much for joining us for another Australia Talks, the official podcast of the r/Australian subreddit. If you have any feedback or suggestions for topics, please get in touch with us on the r/Australian subreddit and email us at australiansubreddit@proton.me. We'd also be grateful if you could subscribe and give us an honest review, as this helps us out immensely. Otherwise, join us next week for another episode of Australia Talks. And remember, at R Australian, we are Australian. Thank you for listening, and tell your mum I love her.
I'm off to call the Tasmanian Premier. Thanks, DK.
See ya.